Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 128, where we discuss an article from Andrew Carton titled, "I'm Not Mopping the Floors, I'm Putting a Man on the Moon: How NASA Leaders Enhance the Meaningfulness of Work by Changing the Meaning of Work," published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 2017. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hi, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Pedro Camacho from Copenhagen.
Hi, this is Sarah calling from London.
Hi, this is Rohan also calling from London. And today's one of the special episodes where we're glad to have the author of the paper that we're discussing. We're discussing Drew Carton's 2018 ASQ paper, "I'm Not Mopping the Floors, I'm Putting a Man on the Moon." It is an award-winning paper that last year won, in fact, the ASQ award for contribution. So the community has recognized it as an award-winning paper. More than that, I am very excited to have Drew here because it was a paper that I read closely during my PhD years, and I found it to be kind of a compelling example of not just a great story and a great setting, but also incredible craftsmanship. And I'm kind of chomping at the bit to discuss with Drew and try to unpack what went into the making of this paper and the crafting of it. So without further ado, Drew.
Well, thanks so much, Rowan, Tom, Sarah, and Pedro for having me. Really excited to talk about the paper and about organizational studies more broadly. I'm Drew Carton. I'm an associate professor of management at the Wharton School.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into doing the paper?
Sure. Yeah. So I was trained by my primary advisor was a social psychologist when I was at Duke University, where I got my PhD. And so when I decided to embark on this paper, it was quite a pivot because it's a very different style of research. It's a different epistemology of research. It's qualitative rather than quantitative, which is my training. And I still remember, if I had to say, okay, there's an original origin story for at least the core idea of the paper, it was when I was in grad school and I was taking the shuttle from LAX to Anaheim, where Academy of Management Conference was going to be held that year. And I sat next to a research assistant at Stanford who was working with Jim Mars. And I still don't know who this person's name is or if they're even still in the field. But they were a big inspiration for me because I was talking about interest and purpose and in vision and in how people see their work or what they see their work connected to. And she mentioned the story, probably apocryphal story, but still a very powerful story of a custodian who was mopping the floors at NASA, and Kennedy was taking a late night tour of the headquarters and came by this custodian and said, "Why are you working so late?" And the custodian said, "Well, because I'm not mopping the floors, I'm putting a man on the moon." And I found that such a powerful exemplar of how our experiences at work, so much of it is in our minds. And as somebody who's my background or my training is largely in psychology, I found that really powerful. So much of what's going on in terms of how we experience the world, how we engage with the world is dictated by our perception of what we're doing. And there's quite a bit of plasticity in terms of how we think what we're doing or what we are doing in any given moment. So that was probably the very initial origin story. And then the paper ended up becoming somewhat of a monstrosity in the years ensuing when I started collecting data in earnest. But at that time, the core idea was planted when I was in grad school. I didn't start the paper until I was an assistant professor, I think probably 3 or 4 years into my tenure at Wharton.
Can I just pick up on one thing in that, which is that you were trained as a social psychologist, as was I. That's where we met a very long time ago, and largely quantitative social scientist in that respect. There's many, many individuals about whom we collect data and many different data points. This is a completely qualitative paper. In fact, it is a masterclass in how to produce a qualitative paper concisely from so many different sources of information. So not even just all interviewing, but archival text, archival video that you converted to text, and other pieces. Can you just explain to us that major pivot, which it sounds like was also only a few years into your tenure track position that you took up this pivot, quant to qual?
Yeah, thanks. I would say, again, retrospectives are always challenging because they're murky, and any particular project has a long evolution with a lot of meandering zigs and zags. So I'm not exactly sure if I could chart this in a high fidelity fashion, but what I remember, a few moments, and one of the critical moments is, so Rowan and I have a colleague in common named Colin Fisher, and he's at UCL. And a dear friend of mine, and I was talking with Colin after a conference. So we have an annual conference at the Wharton School every year for junior faculty. And Colin was attending that year. And so we were talking, a few of us were talking after that day's set of presentations. There was a presentation, a qualitative presentation, and I made a few snide remarks, as a lot of quantitative researchers do, who are looking somewhat skeptically upon the whole enterprise of qualitative research because we don't really understand it, weren't trained or socialized to appreciate it. So I made a couple of remarks, and it made a couple of the qualitative folks in the room, including Colin. I don't know if he would self-classify as a qualitative person, but he certainly is capable of that research and doing it really well. So I made a couple of people a little bit uneasy and unsettled and maybe unhappy with a couple of marks I was making. And so Colin, right before he left that day, right before he got into the cab to go to the airport, he said, I love you, Drew, even though you're an incorrigible positivist. And I remember hearing that and being quite sad, because I thought to myself, you know, that's a very fair jab that he was taking at me for being narrow-minded and not having given an entirely different type of research. It's a fair shot. And so I don't think it maybe not necessarily in that exact moment, but upon reflecting on that feedback over the next few weeks and a few months, I thought to myself, but there's a book I'm reading. I've always been a lover of NASA and of physics, so I'm reading a book on the side on NASA. I'm noticing there's a lot of interesting content here that might lend itself potentially to a qualitative study on purpose. And so maybe I can take a stab at that and actually give this thing a fair shake before I start to criticize it so heavily. And so for a lot of it was just a challenge of my own narrow-mindedness and feeling like, okay, I didn't want to have my whole career just be doing one thing. Another part of it too is just the love of discovery, being, you know, if we're all curious people, and this was an opportunity just to find out more about a topic that I really loved and find out about it in a different way. And the last thing I'll say is what I came to realize along the way is it's just as much about changing your mindset as it is about changing your skill set or acquiring a new set of skills. Sure, you have to acquire a new set of skills, but you also have to look at the world a completely different way. And I was really lucky to have and be surrounded by people like Otilia Obidaru and Spencer Harrison, excellent qualitative researchers who helped me understand that this is not just a new vernacular that you're trying to speak. It's not just a set of tools, but it is a way of looking at the world and acquiring knowledge and acquiring insight. And that was the key shift for me. And I think I had already submitted an initial draft of the paper, gotten some feedback from testy reviewer one, who is clearly the qualitative expert in the crew. And that's when I realized, okay, a major paradigm shift is going to have to happen, not just in terms of what I can do, but also how I think about this topic.
So the paper to describe seems to be as much, as you said, as meaning as about actually the techniques, right? Reading the paper, it's a particular story about purpose, right? And it's one that's trying to get exactly at this idea of meaningfulness. So maybe we could reflect a little bit about the overall story that the theoretical story in particular that the paper is trying to get at through the case of NASA.
Sure. So as I mentioned, the paper started as a probing on this idea of purpose. And I think it ended up slowly evolving to be a bit more about meaningfulness. And of course, these are very highly related ideas. Some would even use them interchangeably. I do think there's a couple important distinctions. Meaningfulness, I think of it's a core psychological need in the sense of we all have, you know, the research varies on this, but there's some consensus that there are 10 to 12 core psychological needs that people have. And by core psychological need, I just mean there's something that is driving us as an end in of itself. We want to experience positive, healthy relationships, a sense of belonging, mastery, a couple other things. And one of the things that we're really interested in gaining is meaningfulness. Meaningfulness is the sense that what we are doing in any given moment is connected to something much bigger than ourselves. It's connected to something that transcends time and transcends place. And we might be occupying a specific location at any given moment, doing a very specific act in a work that we're doing. But we want to feel that, okay, there's something much more wide-ranging and sprawling and far-reaching that our lives and our work is connected to. So that's what meaningfulness is. And I found, I think the epiphany I had, the moment when I realized there might be something here that's really interesting and could captivate people, is when I realized that the very attributes that what leaders and what we in organizations will often aspire to feel that our work is connected to, that are most meaningful, feeling like we're going to have an impact on thousands or millions of people, feeling like we can change the world, feeling like we can make as many customers as happy as possible. These really far-reaching, wide-ranging aspirations are often the precise aspirations that our work feels most disconnected from, because what we're doing in any given 5-minute interval is going to be a much smaller slice of the pie. It's not going to feel that grandiose. When I saw that connection or that disconnect, that's when I thought maybe there's something here worthy of pursuit.
And that, starting now to dive into the paper itself, the first thing that struck me as I was reading through it is that I know I come from a background where there's sort of a mythology of leadership that says that, you know, the leaders provide purpose, and then if they do it correctly, meaningfulness will just naturally emerge. But your initial findings were showing that even with this purpose that was being expressed by the leadership in the form of President Kennedy, that didn't translate to greater meaningfulness. It actually went the other way. Could you kind of expound a little bit on that finding and others that you did as you started to look at Kennedy's actions?
Sure. You know, as so many leaders do, it's very tempting and alluring and seductive to cast what you're trying to do as an organization in the grandest terms possible. And that's certainly what happened at NASA as well. They had a few different high-level aspirations. One was to advance science, to be on the vanguard of technology, to overcome the competitive force that at that time was the Soviet Union and the rivalry with them. So in many ways, they're aiming for, reaching for, and there's probably the first of a number of bad puns today, but they're reaching for the stars, or they're shooting for the moon in that regard. And that was a very grand aspiration, but it was one that so many employees, astronauts, seamstresses who were stitching the spacesuits, people who were working in administration, the custodian we talked about before, they felt that, okay, their work, what they're doing every day, just there was no natural, obvious, self-evident connection between the low-level activities they're engaged in and these grandiose aspirations. And so where Kennedy started was where a lot of leaders end up starting and finishing, which is, okay, just creating in some ways a gap or what I would call a contrast effect between the menial work that they're doing every day, or maybe not menial, but you know, there's tedium in what we do, and feeling like, okay, this tedious task I'm doing right here, but you're telling me I'm going to change the world, I'm going to advance science, we're on the vanguard of technology, we're pushing the frontiers of knowledge. That doesn't feel like what I'm doing right now when I'm just cleaning the valve for this engine. And so that disconnect was very much apparent at NASA. And then even when Kennedy, you know, the most famous step that Kennedy took was in the May of 1961, went to Congress. He said, okay, we're going to try to get to the moon and back before the decade is out. So within the next 8.5 years. So he made a pivotal and important step, which is to create this very concrete stretch goal. But because it was a stretch goal in the sense of it seemed like it was completely out of reach at that time, I think a 20,000 pound capsule into Earth's orbit. And here we're talking about putting a many, many, many ton machine all the way to moon, 240,000 miles away and back. It seemed like it was something that was completely implausible at that time. And so creating this really grand concrete objective didn't necessarily help, at least at first, because it also seemed like there's a very clean break between where we are now and where we want to go. And so that's where the puzzle at that point was just as strong as it ever had been, in the sense of there's this strong disconnect. And then it was a matter of, okay, how are Kennedy and other NASA leaders going to build that link between what the organization is doing, as grand as it is, and what employees are doing as narrow and well-defined as it is?
So this actually reminds me of, there was a blog post by Ezra Zuckerman way back when, where he talks about different framing kinds, and there's the known puzzle and the found puzzle. And let's say the pure inductive thing quite often is you go in, you know, theoretically a tabula rasa, you go in without any particular expectations and you find a puzzle that you're trying to explain, which is the, you know, going back to your interesting demarcation of how it's almost different modes of thought between, let's say, deductive and inductive. I often think of it as, caricature it to the extent of just different ways of being in the world. So even if someone is house hunting, trying to buy a house, a more deductive person might think about certain kind of variables that you care about, and based on that, you know, whatever, school district, this, that, etc. You end up with two neighborhoods and then you explore in those two neighborhoods, versus a more inductive person might just be like, hey, here are six neighborhoods I find interesting. And as you explore, you decide on what kind of variables matter to you. And you might even discover new variables like, I don't know, I care that the backyard is at a lower elevation or something like that. But what you've expressed sounds like it's in between, where it's not that found puzzle where I've just, it's more of a known thing where, look, here are mixed results in the literature. And that's how the paper is framed as well, where we've got a bunch of studies saying that ultimate aspiration is important for meaningfulness. We've got a bunch of studies saying that it's kind of equivocal, the results. In fact, it could even present a negative comparison point if your job is very trivial and you're comparing it. And the way I saw the crafting of this paper, and I'm curious if that's how the project worked or if it just what we see in the end, is it was this in-between thing where it's a known puzzle, you've got a framing like upfront, and that framing is helping you even search through the archives, because you talk about how you used four themes. I think it was meaningfulness, objectives, day-to-day work, and connections. And those four themes were used as a way to filter what is the corpus that you're even going to code. So almost like a pre-code corpus, which also for archives makes sense because archives can be huge. But then was it that guided where you were locked down with that puzzle from the beginning itself?
I definitely think there was this was a hybrid approach in the sense of, you're right, there is a absolutely massive corpus of information. This is archival, so we're not talking about a finite number of interviews with a set number of informants here. We're talking about all known records, and you know, the government had to be transparent in this regard. So we're talking about like thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of transcripts and of videos and of records of all sorts. And so having that amount of information, it does require some structure, some guidelines. At least that's how I looked at it, just to make sense of what is in and what is out, what is excluded versus what's included. I did want to be pretty disciplined, though, to say, okay, once I have my search parameters, decided what is included and what's not, to be as open as possible to what counts as an insight. And this gets back to what I talked about before on really your mindset shifting. For me, it was so hard. To Sarah's question, you know, our training is so quantitative, where you're thinking about, you have a specific set of ideas about how the world works. You have these preconceptions. You're supposed to have preconceptions in the sense that you're relying on the literature or your experience to formulate predictions, and then you test those predictions. But to really try to rid myself as much as possible of any kind of preconception about how things were working at NASA, just confine myself to these search parameters, gather as much relevant data as possible. I can't remember exactly how much now off the top of my head. I want to say it was something like 350 distinct snippets of information that were codable or that could be made sense of as being relevant to those four principles you mentioned before, including vision communication and task work that people were doing and how they feel like their work is connected to the vision. So once we had the raw materials, it's about not imposing as little prejudgment as possible. And that, again, that's what I had a really hard time with because I was trained and socialized in the opposite way. So I would say it's hybrid in that respect. There was some pre-standing structure, but once you have the structure and the parameters laid down at that point, try to abandon as much as possible and almost embrace being lost in a way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me also, because having kind of, let's say, done work in the archives in my dissertation as well, it wasn't as structured as it seems to be in this paper. And that's why I really admired the craftsmanship of it, as I keep saying again and again. But I found myself having to then filter out, let's say in my case, I'm interested in, you know, whatever, secrecy, innovation. I'm filtering it based on that, so that if someone asks me other questions, okay, if someone asks me about meaningfulness, about the actors that I've studied, I actually don't know the answer because I haven't filtered the archives through that angle. It might be an incidental. Once you filter it, and that is, I think, a very valuable point you're making, is then the pure inductive mode comes back in. So once you filtered, you're then, okay. So for example, let's say meaningfulness might pop up even if I filtered for knowledge concealment or sharing or whatever it is. But that there's that hybrid thing that might be peculiar to archival research, especially vast archives, which is an interesting thought.
So we discussed the case of the Manhattan Project, right? I think it's episode 92. And I think what is interesting there is not just that it's also a known case that can be very fruitful to many organizational ideas, but it has the same sense of urgency and almost like war effort and so on, right? And as Raheen was saying, one of the things that we found that we looked at is the challenge is that, of course, that had this element of bringing people together towards a cause, but also had to do in orchestrated secrecy because, you know, everyone is participating. We want to have a wide effort, but also not everyone can and need to know what each piece is doing, right? And how you manage that. And this makes me think that a lot that is coming in this paper is the challenge of seeing. And I think that see is almost like sometimes presented in italics, right? This whole idea about how leaders help, support, enable workers to see their participation in the purpose and whatever is happening, right? So it's a different type, I think, of challenge. And if we were to draw a parallel with the Manhattan Project, there's not so much making sure that people understand their participation, even though they cannot know what each piece is doing. But even if they can, right, there is still the challenge of connecting, as we were saying before, the menial daily work tasks into the broader purpose that is trying to be achieved, right? So I think we could think a bit more about this challenge about seeing and making connections between specific and concrete, between, you know, on the ground and higher purpose and so on.
But you've been talking about purpose, but there's another word that I think we need to talk about with this paper, which is mission, right? Because there's two or three different ways we could approach mission. So if we go from the general organizations and think about mission statements and what we paste on the wall, right? We're taught when we then prepare to teach leadership about the absolute fundamental importance of these mission statements. And that it's the leader's job to set the direction for everyone through these mission statements, right? And I'm pretty sure there's a paper out there that's done an analysis of corporate mission statements from the 80s to the early 2000s. And just the trend towards vanilla, they all sound the same. Is this Procter & Gamble or, you know, is it Johnson & Johnson or is it Lockheed Martin, right? You can't anymore. They're not distinguishable. But the point is they need to be visible and they need to be ever-present reminders and they need to be an orienting thing. And then that's when mission tends towards identity, right? If you don't agree with this statement on the wall, you don't belong in this building. But then there's mission in terms of the sense of a mission to the moon, right? NASA's famous for their projects being organized as missions. A mission to the moon, we now have mission to Mars. So two things that I'm obsessed with this little kernel of an idea here is, one, do you know from your archival work, did they call the missions before this period? Like, would you have called Sputnik a mission, Sputnik? Did they call them missions before this? And then my second question is about mission. What's the difference between mission and purpose and mission and meaning?
So one of the first things to think about is you ask 100 people, you're going to get not 100 different answers, but you might get 15 to 20 different answers. There's some consensus, but enough divergence to be worth noting. But how I typically will hear these terms used. So the first question you asked is what was the language? What was the rhetoric at NASA at the time? Now, my recollection has been 10 years since I've been in the data, so I could be wrong. But my recollection is for the actual push to the moon, they were talking about these more as programs. So it was the Mercury program, the Gemini program, the Apollo program. And the programs were composed of specific missions ranging all the way to, let's say, you know, Apollo 1 to Apollo, whenever it ended, 17, something like that. Those were individual missions. But the term mission, my understanding is it was kicked around. And of course, this is very context dependent. But at NASA, it was pretty well understood that when Kennedy was talking about the organization's ultimate mission, it was usually along the lines of something much more abstract, not an actual event that's going to transpire and take place that has a beginning and an ending. And there's a timestamp and we can celebrate when it's over. It's rather something that's ongoing. And I really love this point you brought up where, okay, there's these two different usages of mission, and I agree. There's the broader use of what the organization mission is, but then we can also think of an organization like NASA that has specific bounded missions that are taking off and then landing somewhere. What they have in common, I think, is that they are projects that are ongoing, and I think it's that nature of what is ongoing. So a mission, typically the way I see it defined is, it's the foundational purpose of the organization in the sense that it's always been here and it will always be there. And it's got that long-lasting evergreen quality. This is relevant to everything that we do in this organization. Whereas a vision might be a little bit more time-bound. We have a vision to achieve a particular outcome by a particular time, or it can be a bit more abstract than that, but it's usually seen as something that is at least temporary or certainly more fleeting than what a mission is. Mission is truly timeless. And then you had asked about the distinction between mission and meaning. Is that right? So with meaning, I say meaning is more what's happening inside of the individual's mind, in the sense of what do they see as their work being connected to? Do they see their work as being actually connected to this ongoing mission? Maybe just the specific delimited mission to the moon and back, or maybe something much grander, which is NASA's mission to advance science. Meaning is that association. Do I see that there's a connection here between what I'm doing on a Tuesday at 3 p.m. in my laboratory, and then what we're ultimately trying to achieve before the decade is out, and then what we're ultimately trying to achieve as an organization across time in a permanent sense.
Yeah, and I'm glad you discussed that, because one thing that surprised me also around the same part of the paper with the change and the shifts in meaningfulness is how the mission actually kind of emerged in Kennedy's communications. It wasn't like an immediate everybody understood, or maybe even he understood what his communication was about the mission when he said, we're going to put somebody on the moon by the end of the decade. There were several stages that you laid out of his communication, which started with narrowing down the scope to a particular important, what was the term? One ulterior purpose. And then from that, it was actually a matter of over the course of a few years that these other messages came out that did things such as set the stepping stones for, you know, what does the path to that mission look like? You know, here are the things we have to do. How do the individuals connect themselves to it? It was a series of steps over a period of time, as opposed to say, here's the mission, kaboom, that's it.
Yeah, if I had to use a visual to convey this, and I remember talking to a colleague at one point, and he was using visual terminology to convey these stages, these steps that you just mentioned. And the way I would think about it is, it's almost like when you're at the top of the organization, you are trying to reach down. I think of like a ladder. You're trying to reach down the ladder, the rungs of the ladder, to make sure that what you're saying is fully accessible and understandable and comprehensible and meaningful and connected to people at the bottom of the ladder. And so you're trying to reach down and build that connection, build the rungs of the ladder so that there's that connection. But then you're then going to try to pull them up the ladder toward where you are. So it's like this two-stage process of, I think in some respects, I didn't write it like this, but in some respects, I feel like Kennedy was starting at the highest possible level. And this is very natural reality of our cognition, is that we'll start very abstract and then we will continually formulate increasingly more concrete instantiations of whatever the topic is that we're thinking about. So we're going to think in a very abstract sense, okay, what are we trying to achieve as an organization? And the first thing he did that's very unique that most leaders don't do is, you know what, we're going to make what NASA is doing just to be about one core thing, which is advancing science. So he fixates everybody's attention on this broader abstract singular mission. And then he says, okay, I'm going to try to break this down into something that is more tangible, that you can chew on it, it's palpable. Okay, so we're going to bring this down to something concrete, get a person to the moon before 1970 and back. And then, okay, you know what, that's not quite fully connected to people's day-to-day experiences. So we're going to think about those stepping stones. How can we break this particular mission up into segments? Well, let's think about three programs, the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program, which are going to have a series of submissions associated with them. And then we're going to have that ladder connected all the way to what people's day-to-day experiences are. And then by having constructed that ladder, we can then pull people up, so to speak, psychologically at least, pull them up to the top of the ladder, make them realize, okay, there's this connection, very clear, strong connection between what they're doing day to day and the organization's ultimate aspirations. And to me, that what I find so revelatory there is just this inherent, very strong paradoxical tension between just how broad and far-reaching what we're trying to do in these massive organizations is versus just how restrictive and narrow the actual, you know, given a particular task is that we're doing at any given moment. Trying to build a connection between those two things, extraordinarily difficult. And Kennedy, I think, had that magical ability to do so. And what's also really interesting there is, you know, he he had all these ingredients put into motion in just the first couple of years in the 1960s, because he was assassinated in 1963, I believe. And so all the ingredients were there, but the momentum was in place for it to success, those dots to be connected for employees for the whole rest of the decade.
What was interesting in your point, Tom? Oh, and as a quick aside, while we were discussing, I looked up the etymology of the word mission. It comes from the Latin for to send. And so let's say in the case of the church, a missionary, someone who is sent to spread the doctrine, or in the case of military, a mission is you're sent for a certain objective. But yes, in today's world, we of course also use it for kind of ultimate purpose as well. And so it's the word mission today incorporates what in this paper is much better kind of separated as ultimate aspiration, concrete objectives, and milestones. And kind of all of those people might colloquially refer to as mission for different reasons, whether it's our mission to advance science, our mission to put a man on the moon, or the Gemini mission, the Apollo mission, etc. But what I liked about Tom's question was it got me thinking about intention, and to what extent could you tell from the archives if Kennedy intended to be doing this kind of a sense giving, or was it just as part of, like you said, there's also a natural tendency to go from the abstract to the concrete. And perhaps for your theorizing, the intention isn't that important because it's about these actions led to these outcomes or these knock-on effects.
And so you're asking about how much was Kennedy's own experience as a communicator, how much of that was, okay, I have a full design on what NASA is trying to do versus I've discovered that at some point in the process, just to clarify.
Plus, like, is it kind of just his natural oratory style, or is there evidence suggesting that, no, I need to make this a single aspiration, otherwise people won't be on board, for example?
It's hard to get into his mind, of course. If I had to distill his talent into maybe just what is the one recurring attribute, it's that he was very effective at simplifying messages in ways that are easy to understand. Very complex phenomena. You have an organization with 400,000 employees that are engaged in many different types of scientific experiments and competition against the Soviet Union and many different stakeholders throughout government. We're going to simplify what everybody's doing, this entire collective, this entire enterprise, to just a few basic objectives. It's very hard. There's a lot of pressure to keep it complex. And there are other leaders at NASA who had an orientation toward keeping it multifaceted, keeping the portfolio of projects as diversified as possible, so to speak. So for him to then resist that and to keep it as simple as possible, I think that speaks to how he understood that the psychology of the typical employee is to, we all have, and there's research been on this subsequent, which, by a number of cognitive psychologists, just how remarkably limited our procedural memory is. So if you want to have your organization's mission be inspiring, be memorable, be something that resonates with people, you got to keep it simple. That's number one. And then number two, you have to find a way, while keeping it simple, to have it link up to what people are actually doing. And that's really hard, because it's easy to keep it simple and have a grand vision and that just 10 words, and then have it sound really inspiring and have people be like, oh, that sounds really cool. Much, much harder to have that exciting, grand, ultimate aspiration, but to actually have it feel connected to what 400,000 people are doing, given that they're doing very, very different things all across this organization. So he had a talent, that 1-2 punch, that I think is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and I think that's spot on also, because I now remember when I was reading the paper, thinking about how perhaps national leaders or politicians also experience this on the campaign trail more, about really simplifying things. On page 338, when you talk about the fourth sense-giving tactic, where Kennedy kind of embeds and metaphorically embodies things into the concrete objectives, there's a quote where Kennedy says, why some say the moon, why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why fly the Atlantic? Now, what I noticed actually was even the fact that he said, why climb the highest mountain? I would automatically say, why climb Everest? And even that is a mini simplification. People might not know what Everest is. Everest might be kind of go over some people's heads, but just say, why climb the highest mountain? It's that kind of ingrained, the level of being able to speak to everyone.
Completely agree. Great point.
So we are organizational nerds, right? And I am remembering that in the episode of Manhattan, we did quite a long time until we talked about, the big figures, right? And trying to think about the organization. And I think your paper has an interesting thing that it is almost sneakily surprisingly organizational, because it starts about, there's a lot about leadership in the framing, that of course Kennedy in the foreground, but you have an interesting point also that it's not a story in which employees are passive, quite the opposite, right? It's almost like the leaders provide resources that then are reconstructed and assembled. I'm struggling with the right metaphor, but somehow are pieces that are then latched on by the active meaning system of the people, right, in making sense and attaching themselves to the different aspects of this meaning architecture about, you know, the higher aspiration, the different programs and so on. So maybe we could think a little bit more about that part of the paper and how it allows to bring a more, let's say, less single heroic leader-centered narrative, but more, let's say, leader in context or leader plus organization or the active role of people into embarking into this process.
Great question. So a lot of us love art, and I think there's a principle in filmmaking. I'm by no means an expert of filmmaking or storytelling within film, but I have heard this recently, which is this idea of the writing in a way where it's 2 + 2 = 4, in the sense that you say 2 + 2 as the creator of the film, and you have the audience add those up for you. And it's really important to have the audience be participants in the storytelling, where they're doing some of the work. So they're active audience members rather than passive audience members. You're not spoon feeding them these insights. And I think this is another talent that Kennedy had, where, and we use this architecture metaphor in the paper that you had mentioned, where you're trying to create this blueprint. You're giving people a structure to make sure that they don't get waylaid or lampooned to some, you know, island that's going to be of no service to themselves or to the organization. So you're giving them some structure. But within that structure, you are then asking them to do the, quote, heavy lifting, another bad pun there. But they're doing the heavy lifting to create the actual facade and bring to life their own understanding and their own signature of what the design is going to look like within the parameters that you've laid out for them. And by being active participants in creating that connection and seeing what that connection is, that agency is preserved and they see it even better. We all know that when we are active participants in any endeavor with learning, any of us who have kids in particular, when we're actively engaged in the process of learning, we learn an insight better. And this is why we often hear one of the best ways to learn something is to teach it. So every time, you know, we all teach, right? So every time we teach something, we learn it that much better. It's the same thing, I think, at NASA is what I found, where we often will focus in leadership and leader communication as this one-way street where I'm going to tell you what the mission is, what the vision is, what the milestones are, but just as if not more important. And I think what really this speaks to here at NASA was just, again, fascinating to go back to what I was saying before. Kennedy was gone by 1963. So you have the vast majority of the time that they are pursuing the man in the moon goal. He's not around to help them connect the dots, but they're doing it themselves. So they have most of this decade. They're using the ingredients that he provided, the blueprint that he provided. They're doing the connecting the dots themselves. So I do think the best leaders in that respect are architects more than they are visionaries.
Yeah, excellent point there. And it kind of brings us to the second half of the paper where you're talking about the 5 stages of connection building. I love the graphic. The graphic really told a good story there, because there at the bottom level, and this is figure 2 on page 340, where you're going through the different stages in which the employees start to see themselves more into the work. And in the bottom row, example of how a NASA employee's conception of everyday work evolved during this time period. I love the way that you depicted it, because it moves from I'm building electrical circuits, which is basically like you can fill in the blank as far as what an individual worker was doing. But as the different stages of connective progress, and it wasn't steady, it was sort of punctuated, that it switches over to I'm putting a person on the moon and I'm advancing science is sort of like the higher end. So the 5 stages of connection was probably my favorite part of the paper, because it sort of describes in very, very great detail what it is that we who do leadership studies aspire to have inspired within the membership, of how a leader's message is supposed to change minds or what have you. But here, this depiction of what it took to actually get those minds changed, very, very significant. And I just wanted to highlight that and then, you know, let you comment.
Yeah. At the same time, what I think it speaks to is how flexible human cognition is. The fact that you can take two people doing the exact same thing. Imagine two people in a cubicle farm working on a spreadsheet, or two people in a lab building electrical circuits. They're both, any observer would say to the two of them, they're doing the exact same thing. But you get in the mind of one and the mind of the other. One person thinks they're building electrical circuits. One person thinks they're putting a man on the moon. Maybe there's a third person. They think that they're advancing science. They have totally different conceptions of what they're doing in that moment. And Aristotle was the first recorded person to make this observation that there's no single way to describe any specific action. And then some psychologists in the 80s with action identification theory, and then especially nowadays with construal level theory, have taken this idea and spun it to a lot of different really, really cool ways of thinking about, okay, in any given moment, I might be doing X, but there's actually 10 or 15 different ways to conceive of how I'm doing X. And the best leaders understand that there's this flexibility in human cognition. And then it's a matter of, how do I give people the framework to understand that this is actually something much bigger than what it appears on the surface to be? The self-evident thing you're doing is building electrical circuits or mopping the floors. But deep down, and ultimately, it's just something much more, much broader and more significant. I will also say that to me, it's somewhat of an absurdist. And I have this other side to me, which is cynical in the sense of, I think that there are a lot of people that try to do this or hope that they can do it, and it backfires, and want to cast a connecting cable wires and saying, hey, we're transforming technology all over the world, and say that this is what you're doing in the moment, and people resist it and they are cynical about it. I find that just as fascinating. So this is a difficult tightrope walk, and you have to have the right ingredients in place. You have to have the right atmosphere, the right culture where people are willing to go along with conceiving of something that inherently seems, or at least on the surface, it seems to be fairly narrow, and then actually think of it as much bigger than what it is. It's something that doesn't just require compelling rhetoric. It also requires people to truly buy in, and we don't always have that.
And just to flag that construal level theory through the Academy of Management side, anyways, being recognized this year, that Professor Bata Riesenfeld is the MOC division's distinguished scholar for 2025. So she's going to be giving an address, which I'm sure will talk about how she came to construal theory and what she uses it for. So she'll be giving an address in Copenhagen this summer. So, you know, you picked up on quite a lot of things there that are still being, you know, popular and very useful for us.
Yeah, so Bhatia is one of the wonderful inspirations for, and I think something she has an especially adept skill at, and I think, you know, there's not many folks that can do this well, is to take an idea that exists in the realm of the, what some people might call the adjacent disciplines, like psychology in this case, and to bring it into the organizational sphere and give it new life and make it very clear why it's organizationally relevant. She has a real talent for that, and did a great job of that true level theory. And that's one of the things where I think get some of the best insights and the best organizational research is taking an idea elsewhere and not just importing it in its own form already, but actually transforming it while importing it and creating new value from it. So she did great work there. And that was certainly an inspiration in this case.
So maybe I come from this from a different background, not so much psychology, right? More sociologists. I keep thinking about the material conditions, right? And you say that yourself towards the end and some points about the moon has very particular characteristics, which were greatly exploited here, that we can all see, that is concrete, that it's very related to the work that is being done, right? So there is some level of materiality, which I think goes into the credibility that you're talking about, that one thinks to have these very loft goals, the others who have them, that they are concrete and also that are aligned to the daily work and existence of these people, right? I think that is also, I think, an important thing to say that, I mean, I don't know the details of NASA, but I imagine that they are public employees and overall they have a positive experience at work, right? So there is room for this kind of poetic talk, right? You know, because, you know, the basic needs are covered. So these two things I think might be important, right? That the kind of work that they are doing has good conditions, and then there is space for this. And also that the particular goal that was constructed, you know, the higher aspiration, has some kind of clear, tangible characteristics that are very credible and fitting for this context.
So yeah, there's no question that being able to have a visual reminder of what it is that you're doing, or at least something that is easier to visualize, is going to amplify the power of effective rhetoric. There's one quote from the data set. I don't remember it verbatim, but it was something to the effect of, you walk outside, you see the moon hovering there in the nighttime sky, and you're reminded of why you're working 16 hours a day in pursuit of this goal. You know, most of my students, I'm sure this is not completely unfamiliar to those of you who teach business school students, but most of the students here at Wharton, they go into finance and consulting, which are two industries that are notoriously difficult to translate into something that's easy to visualize, at least in terms of an ultimate aspiration. So I'm confronted with this issue all the time when I teach. How do we make the kinds of abstract work that we're doing, how do we make that more palpable, more tangible? So there's no question that there are certain industries and certain cultures, like you mentioned, where it is more amenable to this type of rhetoric than others.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.